This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm Bray Blanks, taking a turn in the host seat this week. After agriculture officials confirmed the New World screwworm in a calf in Texas last week, additional cases have been reported this week. Governor Abbott activated the Texas State Emergency Operations Center to level 2. He is urging federal officials to pick up the pace on a facility to fight the flies, saying he expects the screwworm to continue to spread across the state over the next year. But he hopes the sterile fly facility can help end it sooner than later. Meanwhile, West Texas ranchers aren't panicking. KTTZ's Brad Burt has more on what regional officials have to say and how the region's livestock owners are feeling.
For over a year, a top concern for Texas agriculture experts has been the New World screwworm flies, creeping closer to the U.S. from the south, laying eggs that feed on the living tissue of warm-blooded animals. But for many Texas ranchers, watching out for parasites like this has long been part of doing the job. In the 1950s, screwworm infestations devastated herds across the U.S. and were once considered eradicated with efforts from the then newly developed science of releasing sterilized flies to prevent the bugs from reproducing, but cases continued to appear in the decades after. Dace Duke is a cattle rancher south of Coleman in the very heart of Texas. He remembers working for a livestock company as a teenager when screwworms would come through on the cattle.
We were getting in like 1,000, 2,000 head a day, and we'd get some in that had it. But, you know, it's just like they get into a sore, and then you have to clean it out and stuff, put iodine on it.
So far, most Texas cases that have developed have appeared in southern counties, but the pest is moving north quickly and is not restricted to cattle. One case identified in Andrews County in West Texas was linked to a dog from Lee County, New Mexico.
People down south, I don't know what they're dealing with, really. You know, like I say, I've experienced it, but it's been a long time ago. And you definitely know when you have it, because it's a god-awful smell. It's dead animals. Smell because it's rotten flesh.
With new developments in the sterilized fly technique, state officials are cautiously optimistic, but they are putting pressure on the construction of a federal facility to respond to the threat. U.S. Department of Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins joined Governor Greg Abbott in a briefing on Monday at the Nippling Bushland U.S. Livestock Insects Research Laboratory, discussing the state and federal response to the latest screwworm cases.
Our amazing Kerrville scientists, a few standing behind me, are the teams that developed a novel strain for the sterile New World screwworm that doubles production output that we will soon be deploying.
Rollins says this is a situation the department has been monitoring for over a year, but critics like Texas Ag Commissioner Sid Miller have argued the federal response has not been fast enough. When ground broke in April for a USDA facility in Edinburgh to release the new sterilized flies, the goal was to produce 100 million flies per week with operational capability by November 2027. But Texas officials are now saying it must be sooner if it's going to slow a wide-scale effect on the livestock industry. In that time, they're relying on the awareness of Texans. Experts say the New World screwworm can often be easily treated in animals if it can be identified quickly. Alongside the Texas Animal Health Commission, Texas Parks and Wildlife has also joined in the fight, as wild animals are expected to be a particularly tough place for targeting infestations. Philip Kaufman is a professor of entomology at Texas A&M University and chair of the AgriLife Task Force on New World screwworm. He spoke to Texas lawmakers in May about the latest screwworm concern.
We have other issues now that we didn't have 50, 60 years ago. We have a thriving wildlife population, particularly in South Texas. The white-tailed deer population in the 60s was probably at about 1.5 million or so. Across the state, we're over 6 million white-tailed deer now. We have huge numbers of feral hogs. We have all these exotics. All of those are hosts that will only amplify the number of flies in the environment, and all of those animals are next to impossible to capture and treat. And so they are going to be a source of fly populations that the livestock producers are going to be dealing with the impacts of.
Those livestock producers have already been dealing with issues like rising input costs from fuel and materials, drought, and a consolidated cattle industry leading to the smallest U.S. cattle herd in 75 years. As this new fly settles in open wounds like the navel areas of newborn calves, there's a concern that the herd could continue shrinking. Kaufman says it could have a $1.8 billion impact on the Texas cattle industry, but he's confident in Texas producers doing their part in an emergency.
I am cautiously optimistic, and what we talk to producers constantly about, and AgriLife is in the education business, is to be proactive rather than reactive. Ranchers have management plans for hurricanes if you live in the coastal bend. If you're in the panhandle, you have wildfire emergency plans. Develop a screwworm emergency plan. What are you going to do if and when it shows up?
Texas A&M AgriLife Extension, in coordination with the Texas Animal Health Commission, is expected to publish a New World screwworm training module so ranchers can be certified to inspect their animals. On the ranch, Dace Duke is still going about his business, but he's also recommending a closer eye for cattle raisers.
You just have to really watch them. But if you got a bunch of cattle and a bunch of brush, it's very difficult, you know. You got to get on horseback and get in there and check them all.
Duke says he'll still be going to the sale barns and taking care of his cattle, even if the work just got a bit tougher, and he gave a very simple reason for it.
Everybody tells me, why don't you quit, you know, you relax a little bit. I say, yeah, but I enjoy it. So I'm just going to keep on going.
Suspected cases can be reported to the Texas Animal Health Commission 24-hour veterinarian call line at 1-800-550-8242. People who observe wildlife showing signs of infestation or unusual wounds are asked to report it immediately to the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department biologists at 512-389-4505. I'm Brad Burt in Lubbock.
It's been just a couple of weeks since the primary runoff election confirmed Tom Sell as the Republican nominee for Texas U.S. Congressional District 19. An outgoing Republican congressman, Jody Arrington, says he is already feeling lighter. KTTZ's Samantha Larned spoke to Arrington about the results of the Republican primary.
Arrington took office representing District 19 in 2017. He was born in Plainview and attended Texas Tech University, where he met the party's latest nominee for the seat, Tom Sell, more than 30 years ago.
He has some unique experiences having served in Washington. One of my predecessors, Congressman Larry Combest, was chairman of the Ag Committee, and Tom was the lead staffer that ran the Ag Committee. So Tom has forgotten more about ag policy than most people know.
It's that knowledge of how to negotiate federal agriculture policy that has built a career for Sell as an agriculture lobbyist in Washington, D.C. And Arrington says that experience gives Sell a few advantages.
Tom Sell has worked on a farm bill before. I mean, not many candidates for Congress, including myself, have had that experience.
The experience as a lobbyist and years of work in the Capitol were also the basis of arguments from District 19 voters against Sell, who felt the insider connections were part of why Sell's campaign raised more funds than his primary runoff opponent, Abraham Enriquez. Sell's campaign raised over $2 million, more than three times what Enriquez raised. Still, the public back and forth between the two District 19 Republican candidates remained relatively civil through the primary, a sharp contrast to other state GOP races, such as the Senate nomination race between incumbent John Cornyn and winner Ken Paxton, and the Texas Attorney General nomination race between Congressman Chip Roy and winner State Senator Mays Middleton. Sell says that shared values and a policy-based campaign were key points for him in the primary race.
You know, we just wanted to run a kind of a distinctly positive race. It's kind of different from much of the political culture that we know these days. And, I want West Texas to be a real light for the entire nation in that way.
Along with Arrington, Sell says he wants to champion the legacy of former Republican representatives for District 19 like Combest and Randy Neugebauer.
You know, I feel the weight of expectations on that. The people of the 19th district, expect a lot from their member of Congress to not only be a champion for kind of the conservative values that we know and love and the productivity that we're known for in West Texas, but to do it in an honorable and good way.
District 19 is considered one of the most conservative districts in Texas. Republicans have held the congressional seat since 1985. But from the time it was established in 1935 up until 1985, the district was represented by Democratic congressmen George H. Mahon and Kent Hance. Even after securing his win for the Republican nomination, Sell acknowledges his campaign isn't over. Sell will be running against Democratic candidate Kyle Rabel in the November general election. Whatever the party, Arrington's successor will be tasked with representing a largely rural district. Of the 33 counties included in District 19, 24 are recognized as rural by the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
If our families don't have access to basic care in rural America, and we don't have a sustainable financial model for rural hospitals and providers, then it's going to be tough to keep families that are there in support of the food, fuel, and fiber production that we do better than anyone.
Arrington authored legislation which created the Rural Health Transformation Program. Part of the One Big Beautiful Bill signed into law in 2025, the program allocated $50 billion to be given to state governments for the purpose of developing rural health infrastructure. Despite the historic investment in rural health, many, including the National Rural Health Association and the health policy organization KFF, are concerned it's not enough to offset the projected spending decrease in rural areas due to Medicaid cuts. However, those Medicaid cuts address another of Arrington's cornerstone issues, federal spending. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that over the next 10 years, the bill will reduce federal Medicaid spending by more than $90 billion. Arrington has been the chairman of the U.S. House Budget Committee since 2023, and earlier this year, he said that in that time, the GOP has decreased the operating budget by $40 billion and cut $1.5 trillion in what he called waste and fraud.
We made some progress. I'm very proud of it, but not enough to stave off a looming debt-related crisis. So Tom is going to need to, he's going to need to grab the bull by the horns on that one. Because everything's affected, farm bills, defense policies and spending, our infrastructure, everything will collapse if we go through a debt crisis.
Arrington says fiscal reform is one of the closest issues to his heart, and he hopes the work is continued through reduced spending and pro-growth policies. In Lubbock, I'm Samantha Larned.
This is the West Texas Dispatch. 500,000 fewer Texans are receiving help through the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, this year compared to last. Taylor County has seen a 14% decline in SNAP participation since the new rules went into effect, requiring able-bodied people to document 20 hours of work per week in order to remain eligible. The new rule also raises the age limit on work requirements from 54 to 64. The Food Bank of West Central Texas had already been planning efforts to expand its service with mobile food pantries and a construction project to create a drive-through pantry. Well, that drive-through pantry is now open. And Brock Baird with the Food Bank of West Central Texas is here to tell us about it. Brock, thank you for coming by the studios today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we mentioned the decline in SNAP participation. Can you kind of tell us what the Food Bank is seeing as far as the need in the big country?
Yeah, so even though participation in federally funded programs is in a decline because of new regulation, that doesn't mean that the need just magically goes away. On the contrary, with inflation and rising grocery bills, the need is higher than it has been in years, I would say, probably even ever.
Yeah, it does sound like you guys are overcoming a lot of challenges to serve our population.
Yeah.
Well, as we said, you'd been planning on taking steps to increase the service that you provide. What did it take to pull all this together, the construction projects, the drive-through pantry? I know that there's been a lot of fundraising. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, it really started with the vision of our late CEO, Ronnie Kidd, who unfortunately passed away earlier this year. But he had a vision for a community center and a mobile drive-through to where we would be more active in food distribution in our community. It's not super common knowledge, like the difference between a food bank and a food pantry. A lot of people use those terms interchangeably, but there is a difference between the two. And so typically a food bank doesn't give food out to the public. We're more of like a warehouse hub to distribute to food pantries and then allow them to distribute to. But with the add-on of this mobile drive-through, we actually are able to position ourselves not only as a food bank, but as a food pantry. And so our goal with doing that is to fill in the gaps in Taylor County where there no food pantry is open. And so a lot of times these partner agencies or food pantries are run by volunteers. And so it's typically people who will open their food pantry when they can, right? And so there's not like a consistent Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, go get food. It's kind of all sporadic throughout the week. And so what we've done with our drive-through pantry now that it's open is we've looked through all the data and we have picked days and times where no other pantry is open. And now we're going to fill in those gaps with that. So a big one is like Saturday morning or even just on the weekend. It's really, really difficult to secure food for the weekend because no other pantry is open on a Saturday and Sunday. And so that's how it started. A lot of fundraising involved with it. It was a multi-million dollar campaign to get this add-on to our warehouse built. And so before that, we are located at 5505 North First Street. And if you go out there, it's just a bunch of factories and warehouses. And I mean, we're a warehouse. We're a food bank. We store a lot of food. But this new add-on allows us to have a community center where we can invite people in and then help volunteers have more to do and more space, and then obviously serving our neighbors as well.
Yeah, I'm sure they all appreciate your service immensely. So the drive-thru is open now. How did it go? Kind of looking back, are there any kinks to work out, or are you pleased with how it went?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think overall we're thrilled with the end result. Park Hill designed the space, and Crow Construction helped put it all together and build it. And, you know, the Diane Owens Graves Foundation and a lot of other people, HEB, Feeding America, they've all really came together to help us build this pinnacle of ending hunger in West Central Texas, which is our mission. I think there's always going to be room for improvement in terms of processes and like figuring out the schedules and what works best for people. And then just getting the word out to everyone is obviously the hardest part about raising the awareness in it. But I think overall we're so excited about it.
Yeah, it's a fantastic addition for sure. So what do people need to know when they come? Are there any kind of disclaimers that you'd like to have them know, or processes that would be helpful?
Yeah. So Senior Resource Day is really geared towards Taylor County residents who are 55 or older, but any of our other distributions, you don't need to bring anything. You don't need to like apply ahead of time or anything like that. You literally just show up. You'll answer a couple questions like, hey, what's your income? Do you live in this county? And based upon those responses, we'll determine if you're qualified for it. Most of the time people are. And we do have what we call unqualifying or non-qualifying events, to where we don't even ask any questions. But when we're using USDA commodities, we do have to ask those questions for reporting purposes. And that's really the only reason. We're not trying to judge anybody. We're not trying to catch anybody, you know, operating outside those boundaries or anything like that. We're just trying to get food to as many people as we can. So really just show up and get the food that you need and the assistance that you need.
Absolutely. And you mentioned the need for volunteers. Are these kind of explain what people can do who want to get involved and make a difference?
Yeah. So the Food Bank of West Central Texas, like I said, serves 13 counties. Last year in 2025, we moved over 4 million pounds of food across these 13 counties, serving over 87,000 residents throughout these 13 counties. And we are a staff of 15. And so we rely very heavily on volunteers. And so volunteers do everything from sorting food, because we will do retail recovery from grocery stores and other places. And we have to sort through all that food to make sure, is it usable? Is it expired? Is it broken? You know, we still have to follow food safety guidelines. And so sorting food, packing food for food pantries, packing food for mobile food distributions, serving or volunteering at those mobile food distributions as well. To me, that's the most fun part, is getting able to actually like meet everybody and load their vehicles up with food and get to talk to them. That's my favorite part. But there's always something to do at the food bank. And you can, if you want to volunteer, you can go to feedtexans.org, and there's a volunteer tab, and you can just see all the volunteer opportunities that are available. You create a little account and sign up and come out.
Perfect. Well, never a better time or more important time for people to step up when, you know, the food shortage is critical for these families in need.
Yes.
Yeah. Without sharing any private details, I was wondering if you could give us an encounter maybe that illustrates the impact that the Food Bank of West Central Texas has had on our community, a family maybe.
Yeah. So the person that I always think of is this sweet woman named Connie Outen. she caught my eye because when you pull up to a mobile food distribution, we see how many households you're picking up for. And it was her and one other lady in the vehicle, and she's picking up for 8 families. And so immediately caught my attention saying, what is this sweet old woman doing picking up 8 family or 8 households worth of food, which is about 400 pounds worth of food. It's a lot. And so getting to speak with her, she was the only one in her little community of neighbors who are all senior citizens, all retired. She's the only one with transportation, and none of them are making enough money based on with their social security checks and stuff like that to buy groceries. And so she picks up for all of her neighbors, and she just told me that, you know, nothing goes to waste. They're so grateful for the food that they receive. If they get something that one of them doesn't like pickles or something, they'll call each other and, you know, they'll share between each other to make sure nothing goes to waste. And I asked her, I said, well, what would you guys be doing if we weren't coming out and doing this mobile distribution in the county? She goes, well, I would have to be calling my kids and grandkids for grocery money. Some of my friends don't have any family, or some of my neighbors don't have any family, so they would just be starving. They wouldn't know what to do. And that just really moved me, the fact that, you know, we're able to get food into the communities, but it really is our wonderful West Texas community that empowers and strengthens one another and looking out for one another. And I think that's the thing that I love about being a Texan the most, is that we'll never just leave somebody in the dust. We're always going to be there to lend a hand.
Absolutely. That's a touching story. Thanks for sharing that. Brock Baird with the Food Bank of West Central Texas. Thanks again for joining us here on the West Texas Dispatch. The drive-through pantry will be open at 5505 North 1st Street in Abilene this Saturday morning from 9 to 10:30 and next Monday from 4:30 to 6 p.m. There is, of course, more information at fbwct.org. Big Bend is one of the more remote and less visited national parks in the country, but it's been getting some national attention in recent months. Federal officials have faced scrutiny over constantly changing plans to construct a border wall through the protected region, and vital changes to the park's most popular area have been put on hold. The Texas Standard's Justin Dowd visited the park to explore the potential impact of those delays.
Known for its rugged and remote desert beauty, Big Bend National Park is not for the faint of heart. It's bigger than Rhode Island, with hundreds of miles of paved and dirt roads weaving through rough terrain and shifting elevation. In 2024, the park welcomed just 500,000 visitors, less than 5% of what the most visited park sees annually. But for those Texans and dedicated travelers that commit to the journey, the reward is spectacular. Big Bend is recognized globally as one of the best places on Earth to stargaze because of the low light pollution. And the rare curve in the river's flow, the park's namesake, creates stunning vistas in one of the world's most pristine ecological preserves. The park's most popular stopover is the Chisos Mountain Basin, accessible only by one narrow, curvy two-lane road. At the end of that 7-mile stretch, the only in-park lodging sits alongside a visitor center and lone food truck, the only hot meal for tens of miles in any direction. In all honesty, surrounded by stunning views and breathtaking scenery, the lodge building is not much to look at. It's run down, with shingles missing from rooftops and a foundation crumbling below.
There's holes in this overhang right here. You can tell that the buildings are just smaller and older. The interiors are definitely dated. You know, you can tell that they've done the best that they can, but you know, you look at the bedspreads and such, and it's like, is that clean?
Liz Turner was visiting from Austin. This was her first trip to Big Bend, and she was staying in one of the lodge's classic motel rooms. She's far from the only one who thinks the 1964 lodge is overdue for a facelift. In fact, Lauren Reamer, the executive director of the nonprofit Big Bend Conservancy, says it goes far beyond that. It needs serious structural repairs.
There's portions of the foundation that are cracking. And if you even just look at the back side of the lodge, you can kind of see an area where it looks like it's just about to fall off the hill. We always kind of joke that you could roll a tomato down the floor and it should just keep going.
That's why, under a 2020 bill benefiting the National Park Service, Big Bend was slated to receive more than $75 million in federal funds to repair the lodge and the Chisos Basin water infrastructure, two separate projects addressing urgent needs in the area. The repairs would have forced the section of the park to close for up to 2 years. That was set to begin May 1st. Tourists from across the state and country made reservations ahead of the closure, looking to visit the hotspot before it shuttered to the public. Turner was one of those.
Big Bend had been on my list for a while, and then I'd heard there was a combination of hearing about this section going to be closed for 2 years combined with putting up the wall. I was like, well, I better hurry up and get out here and see it.
But in early April, just a month before construction was set to begin, the National Park Service abruptly called off the projects, citing substantial budget shortfalls. No further information was given, and the park's website still includes the project plans with a May 1st closure date listed, just under a one-line banner announcing the project's cancellation.
I don't think the Park Service at this point knows what it's going to do. I will say the decision was made by the national office, not by the park. And I think the park is having to now explain it to people and answer questions of what are you going to do? And frankly, I don't think they have the control over the answers to those questions right now.
That's Bob Krumenager, the park superintendent from 2018 to 2023, and one of the people who worked on plans for the renovations to begin. He says the decision to fund the renovations now was long overdue.
Well, it was actually a sense of urgency, so it wasn't necessarily something that I wanted to do. It was something that I thought I had to do.
To reach the Chisos Mountains Basin, water is carried from Oak Spring at the base up 1,300 feet through pipes laid decades ago. Pipes that some advocates say were already used before they were laid way back then. Krumenager says the basin's water infrastructure is already decades past its life expectancy, and repairs are needed now more than ever in the face of severe drought.
So the leakage continues, the need for additional storage continues, and so hopefully the delay of the water project will not be too long, because the risk is catastrophic failure at some point. And then you may have no water at all, and whatever visitor activity and facilities you have up there would be really in a tremendous bind. And from a fire management perspective and firefighting, that would also be a serious consideration.
The planned renovations were already a scaled-down version of what park leaders think is needed long-term. The idea was to buy the National Park Service 10 to 20 more years of water access while they found the money for a more permanent fix. Now, even that Band-Aid is being withheld. Big Bend Conservancy's Lauren Reamer said the decision to wait was made after the price estimate for lodge renovations came in at nearly double what was originally allocated, and that the water project can hopefully resume as soon as it's bid back out separate from the lodge restoration. That process, however, could have its own problems, raising questions over the logistics and cost of separating the two pursuits.
Ideally, all of this would happen at once. And that's primarily to avoid having multiple closures in the basin over the year. All of those water lines, anything that has a flushing toilet, a running faucet, has a pipe that runs to it under the ground. So renovating those water lines is going to create quite a bit of disruption in the basin because, you know, those things are going to have to be dug up to be replaced.
Some local residents view the delay as a step in the right direction. James Evans, a photographer who lives near Big Bend, believes the area should remain preserved and undeveloped. To Evans, the initial construction in the basin was a negative from the outset. It's just one example of the broad range of perspectives facing the park today. This shakeup is the latest in a string of changes for the National Park Service. Big Bend National Park is one of the many NPS sites nationwide facing severe staffing shortages. Former Superintendent Bob Krumenager says three of the park's five division chief positions are currently without a permanent appointment, including the head of maintenance, and the park doesn't have a deputy superintendent, the second in command. Add in proposed budget cuts that would slash already reduced NPS funding by nearly a quarter as visitation numbers reach record highs nationwide, and advocates say Big Bend is in a difficult spot. In the meantime, the pipes continue to leak, and concerns over the park's ability to combat dangerous fire seasons continue to grow, with no word on when or if the projects will be reinstated. The National Park Service declined to answer specific questions, but a spokesperson said the agency is continuing to evaluate the best path forward for both projects. I'm Justin Dow.
Time for West Texas Roots. Since 2012, families across the country have come to Abilene to visit the Children's Art and Literacy Festival, always known as CAF to us. But what is the story behind the festival, and how did it grow so rapidly? Former Mayor Gary McCaleb recalls how an ordinary book reading at a local elementary school turned Abilene into the storybook capital of America.
Yeah, I would say that it began because of something that began earlier than that, which is known as the NICL, the National Center for Children's Illustrated Literature. And that started because, so there's a kind of a long story that just kept growing. In 1993, William Joyce wrote this book entitled Santa Calls. And to no one's awareness, he set the story as saying these kids grew up in Abilene, Texas, in the book. Different elementary schools in Abilene would have times that they would call somebody in Abilene to come out and read a book to the kids and then talk about the importance of reading. And so one of the people they would call frequently would be the mayor. I happened to be the mayor at that time. And after two or three of those calls, I remember I told my assistant, I said, anytime they call and want to know if I'll come read them a book, just tell them, yes, I will. Tell them to go ahead and pick out a book and I'll come out and read it. So that's what happened. And when I opened that book and it said they lived in Abilene, Texas, that prompted a phone call to Shreveport, Louisiana, inviting him to come to Abilene. And he came to Abilene and we had a big luncheon. And in a conversation there, we began talking about getting kids connected to books. Both, in fact, William Joyce made this statement when we first, I was talking to him about that first book, Santa Calls, and I said, you know, this is really a well-written story, and it's really good quality art, his illustrations. And I remember his response. He said, well, it should be, because children's books are the first literature and the first art that children are ever exposed to. And they ought to see something good and read something good. And so in that discussion with William Joyce, the author and illustrator, I asked him, I said, is there any place that collects the best of the children's literature and the best of children's books, illustrations? He said, I don't know of any place like that. And so we said, well, then maybe we ought to be that place. And it was just sort of something that kept unwinding. And out of that beginning of that book being set in Abilene, Texas, became the NICL, the National Center for Children's Illustrated Literature. And that started in 93. And then that grew each year in different ways as more people became aware of it. And each year another illustrator would be invited in as a guest and would show, we would have an exhibit of that illustrator's work. And then it would tour throughout the United States, and as these pieces grew more and more, then the idea of starting the CAF Festival, which is the Children's Art and Literacy Festival, came to life as just another time. And so it's always been about this time in June every year. A particular illustrator's work is featured, and there's parades, and there's all kinds of things going on during that whole weekend for kids to come in. So if you look back at it, you think, okay, well, maybe if I hadn't been mayor, I wouldn't have been involved, but whoever was mayor might have been involved. And then maybe you can look back and say, but if William Joyce hadn't said the book was in Abilene, Texas, if he had said it was in some other place, it probably wouldn't have resonated the same way. And you can even say, and if I'd gone out to the elementary school that day and the lady had picked out a different book instead of this book. So there's all these different little pieces in it that kind of came together.
By the way, we recorded Gary McCaleb's story of how the calf began at his home. This is the West Texas Dispatch. This year, as America celebrates its 250th anniversary, the Texas Standard is launching a project celebrating the rich history of music in the Lone Star State. We want to share the fun with you. Here's the first installment of the series.
I'm Matt Riley from KUTX, and as we look towards the 250th birthday of the United States, we're celebrating with the Texas 250, the Lone Star State's contribution to American music. Here's a moment when Texas music had the world's attention. February 26th, 1995. A record-breaking 66,994 fans packed the Astrodome to watch a performance from native daughter Selena as a part of the Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo. This was to be her final concert there and became her last televised performance, and immortalizing her iconic purple jumpsuit. Known today as Selena Live, The Last Concert, the legendary 1995 show featured a 55-minute set list of her biggest hits. She performed without any water breaks, singing entirely live while wearing 6-inch heels on a rotating stage. The concert was televised live on Univision. Tragically, this was the last major televised performance of her career, as she was murdered just over a month later on March 31st, 1995. The performance was later released as a live album and concert film, and it is available to stream on various platforms. You can see more about this moment at texasstandard.org/Texas250. And we want to hear from you. We're counting down the 250 essential Texas songs July 3rd and 4th on KUTX, and you can cast your vote for your favorite Texas song at texasstandard.org/Texas250.
KACU's social media to find out how you can share your favorite songs of, by, and about Texas. You can find us at KACU895 on Facebook and Instagram. Shakespeare is still alive and well here in Abilene. The biannual Abilene Shakespeare Festival starts today and runs through the 14th. KACU's arts and culture reporter Allison Diaz has more.
From mistaken identities and slapstick comedy to royal intrigue, lost family, and one of Shakespeare's most famous bear chases, the Abilene Shakespeare Festival returns to Folks Theater this week. For the last month, ACU theater students, community members, and directors Adam Hester and Gary Varner have been preparing this summer's production of The Comedy of Errors and The Winter's Tale. The directors of both shows have worked to make them easier for modern audiences to follow. Varner, who has spent 45 years with Shakespeare's plays, says The Comedy of Errors takes a particularly unique approach.
And I wanted to try to make it accessible and simplify it down so that it was just the basic story plot I lucked out and I got to see a production of it in London. We saw it at Stratford-on-Avon. And they played with it so much. They're making it fit the people that are coming to see it. We've tried to make it our own and play with the audience, and it is a show within a show.
To help audiences keep up with the story, Varner created a prologue that sets the stage for the action. His version imagines a small theater troupe, the Rockport Shakespeare Company, scrambling to perform the comedy of errors despite not having enough actors for all the roles.
Since there's two sets of twins, we decided they would play each other, and it gets confusing, and so we had to get the audience involved.
Now a madman? Why the PVC ship of that doesn't have no weight for me?
ACU Theater Junior Nathaniel Richley portrays one set of twins. Not only does Nathaniel play two roles in the comedy production, he is also part of the cast of The Winter's Tale. He has had to learn both shows' scripts and blocking, and will perform both shows this week.
For me, at least, I found it comes in like three processes. The first is memorizing the words, and then the second is like understanding them in the like how they flow for the show, because each show is very different. The comedy is a lot faster paced and a lot more modern and easier for the audience to understand. And then Winter's Tale is very, very verse based, and it's all just in like Shakespearean rhythm. And then the third part is just getting it to where it feels natural with the other people on the stage.
Yeah. And that is important when what you're doing on stage includes dancing. Kendall West says the cast learned a lot of new choreography for Winter's Tale.
And I feel like it's different dancing than we've kind of ever done before. It's more like folky, which is cool. Yeah. We had to learn how to adapt our dancing to that different style of dancing that this show required.
Kendall and Nathaniel are part of ACU's theater department, but the Shakespeare Festival brings together a cast that includes community members and veterans of the theater, like Victoria Spangler. She is associate professor and department head of theater at Hardin-Simmons University. Spangler says one of the most rewarding parts of the production has been working with the eclectic mix of actors.
It's been a wonderful practice and experience. I've loved the people I've met, the students and the non-students, and to get to work with and add in people I really admire.
Another part of the updated approach in this year's festival is the costuming. Director Adam Hester says costume designer Catherine Baumgartner had the idea to give The Winter's Tale a Game of Thrones-inspired look.
It was a no-brainer. All the elements that go with the play itself just fit perfectly. Some of the elements in Game of Thrones, I had already had a series of words that were going to be guiding me. Those are all kind of found in Game of Thrones as well. So I was going, yes, magic, mystery, wonder, all of these are there. This is perfect.
The festival helps to keep the spirit of Shakespeare's works alive with fresh interpretations of timeless stories for modern audiences. And the community has three different opportunities to catch each one of the shows between now and Sunday. Kendall West encourages locals to fit both of them into their calendars this week.
Gary and Adam are so different, and the shows are so very different, which is why you should come see both, because they're all so different. So.
The Shakespeare Festival is free to the public. For showtimes, check the ACU Theater website. I'm Allison Diaz in Abilene.
Thanks for tuning into the West Texas Dispatch. I'm Bray Blanks. Been fun to take a turn in the host seat, and I hope you'll join us again next week when we bring you a roundup of news from our region all the way to the western edge of the Lone Star State. The West Texas Dispatch is available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and on the KACU mobile app. We had help this week from our executive producer, Heather Claiborne, producers Shayla Conley and Caleb Leger, and our digital editor, Calvin Claiborne. Special thanks to J.C. Gamble, who wrote our theme. I'm Bray Blanks.